Ole Mac and Melissa Sinclair have spent several years developing a block of land that focuses on resilient solutions for food production, shelter, energy and water. Cosmo Kentish Barnes visited their property in North Canterbury called Block Hill to find out more.
We're near Parnassus, which is north of Cheviot. This is the Leader Valley, and there's a number of little streams that run down through here that lead into the Leader River, which in turn runs into the Waiau River.
The hills are looking quite green.
Yeah, they are. We've had, I'd say, sort of 60 mils or so in the last week and a bit, which has really helped with the growth of grass, and I think a lot of the farmers will be happy about that.
It's been quite dry, hasn't it, here recently?
It has been. I think they say it's one of the worst droughts in 40 years. We haven't noticed it really badly here on our block, partly because we've done a lot in the last few years to sort of prepare for this kind of situation, because it was clear that it was going to happen eventually, and because we're not grazing livestock really, the grass production is not really that important to us, so the established trees and stuff, they've got such deep roots they don't notice it the same.
Tell me about what you are doing here.
What we're trying to do is create a simple lifestyle that allows us to live comfortably on this small piece of land in a sort of natural setting, trying to keep it low tech, low maintenance where possible, and growing a lot of perennial sort of long-term types of plants that obviously have benefits for people, but also a lot of emphasis on growing things to support the rest of the natural system. So whether that's insects or the birds or whatever, they're all part of this bigger system. And I guess in some ways it starts with the water, and so that's what I sort of alluded to in terms of the changes we've made to help with the drought issue. We've laid out a lot of contour swales to catch the rainfall that's coming off the land, but also off all of the buildings. So the water, instead of running off the land once it's been saturated, now has all these collection pools and ponds and channels and ditches and stuff which catch the water and allow it to soak in and really charge up the ground with water, and that allows for better growth and then feeds all of everything from the soil, microorganisms, all the way up through the insects and small animals and birds, and it's starting to really show. It's taken a while obviously to get all the changes in place, but also for that system to really start to respond and to fully charge up, and it's looking really good right now.
Melissa, how would you describe the land that you've got here?
I'd say it's very natural, and it just sort of drops off. There's a cliff right close by, actually, and it's sort of like a peninsula shape, and that's part of why we've been working with these swales to sort of slow the water down, because otherwise it just runs straight off the cliff.
We noticed quite early on that, you know, when you stand down the bottom of the cliff and look back up, you could see water sort of coming, seeping through the cliff, and so we've caught the rainwater off the roof of the house and off the porch decking roof, and it sort of travels down through the land. So the top, the swales at the top of the landscape fill up with water first, and then over the next day or so, depending on how much rain you've had, that water passes through the land, and you'll see it filling up the swales down the slope over time, It's interesting to watch the water, and I've heard that it moves about 1,000 times slower through the soil than over the surface, so it's obviously going to be dependent on the structure of the soil and stuff.
It's not often I hear the word swale being used. Why do you think that is?
It's a really good question. I think that we don't really value water highly enough in many ways. I think because we do generally get a lot of rain, most of the time it's something we don't have to think about. And if people are thinking about it, it's usually about how to get rid of it. How can we drain this area? How can we stop the road getting eaten away by the river or whatever? And it's more about water is more of almost like a nuisance to people until there's not enough of it. And then suddenly it becomes a big deal. And people get excited by technological kind of quick fixes like big irrigator systems and stuff, which seem like all, I don't know, macho and exciting or something. But I think that the more appropriate solutions is lots and lots of small scale systems that are all, you know, they don't even have to be connected, but by making lots of small changes, you can have a huge, big impact. And there are places, you know, historically where this has been done, and even in modern times, there's a great project that they've been doing in China, a huge area, something like 30,000 square kilometers. It's been rehabilitated by peasants with shovels creating terraces and swales and dams and just keeping water on the landscape. So it's nothing new. It's been around for a long time. It's just people have forgotten about it because we have electric pumps and stuff.
So a simple definition for a swale would be what?
It's a ditch on contour that traps water that's coming off the landscape. Yeah.
And on top of the soil wall is where you plant your vegetables and fruit trees and things.
That's right, yeah. Well, we use a couple of different areas, either on top of the mound where the soil was, of the soil that was excavated, and that's generally slightly drier because it's raised above the rest of the surrounding soil, and then just on the downhill side of that raised area, sort of the seam between that dirt and the original ground level, that's quite a damp area. And then if you want a really wet area, you can plant into the trench itself. So there's sort of three different variations in the types of moisture that you have there, and so different plants will be more appropriate for one of those three areas.
Melissa, this looks quite different to a standard vegetable garden.
Yeah, we don't have things planted in rows like most people. We've done things in a way that I guess could look a bit chaotic to some, but to us it just looks quite natural. And you have to be quite good at plant identification. We've mixed everything together, so you really need to know what you're looking for when you go hunting around for your dinner.
And what sort of things do you grow?
All sorts. We've got silver beet, kale, carrots, lettuce. Certain times of year we'll have tomatoes and capsicums, and we grow calendulas, which are a type of edible flower, and lots of different herbs, garlic, potatoes, pretty much everything you might want to eat. But also we grow things that sort of companion planting style, so growing things all mixed together to help with some of the pests. Yeah, so there's lots here.
Have you planted a lot of trees since you've been here?
Yes, we have. We've planted a lot of fruit trees and nut trees, but also a lot of, again, they're kind of companion trees or nurse type trees that will help improve the conditions for the other trees that are coming. So there's one that's one of my favorites, the Tagacestia or tree lucerne, which is a smallish tree, evergreen, and it's a nitrogen fixer, so it's helping improve the soil fertility for the other plants that are around. And it can be used as a fast-growing windbreak. It has these white sort of pea-like flowers on it, which the bees love, and the native wood pigeons, they love it. And the other thing which I've been experimenting with is, because it is so fast-growing and it's evergreen and it doesn't really compete that much with other plants, I've been using it a bit like an umbrella or a canopy to grow frost-tender stuff underneath of, so above citrus trees, for example. So I can make a bit of a protection by growing these other trees and use it to shelter the citrus or passion fruit or other things.
We've got plum trees, apple trees, peach trees, almond, pear trees.
There's a nashi pear.
Oh yeah, nashi
well.
Pear. So I do a lot of preserving in the summer. Yeah, there's quite a lot to harvest, and I stew some of it up and put it in the freezer for later. It's quite a good way.
And there's a little one here with the sort of umbrella thing over is the cherry tree.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the one we have to cover for the birds. It's a dwarf tree, so it makes it fairly easy to get a cover over it. And that's one of the first fruit trees really in the season that we'll get something off.
We're trying to get as much variety as we can, just so that things are coming ripe different times of year. And then, like I said, if I preserve some, then at the point where there isn't any, then we can go to the preserved fruit.
We have quite a big focus too on the perennial stuff, so obviously trees, but also things like rhubarb and asparagus, things that you only have to plant once but that keep coming. I mean, you need to maybe fertilize them and such, but it's not a process of having to, you know, prepare ground and plant seed and wait for it to be ready, and once it's there you can kind of sort of forget about it to a certain extent, and then it just comes back at that time of the year and you can use it. So yeah,
you've put tons of work into this land. What is your main motivation?
I guess that it'd have to be that we actually enjoy doing it. There's also knowledge that this is sort of an investment. We're putting energy in now and it will be delivering yield down the track with less, hopefully, in theory, if we've designed it right and chosen the right types of plants. And down the track, it'll start to be giving quite a lot back without too much more input. I mean, especially the trees and stuff, you know, once you've planted them and pruned them and gotten to the big size, there's not a lot of attention that they really need, and then they can be produced. I mean, even just off this one plum tree, we get more plums than we can eat, and now we have probably 10 plum trees, you know, and 20 pear trees and stuff. So
the pigs get to eat some as well, which they like.
Talking about the pigs, should we go and meet them?
Head out that way. We'll go through here. You might want to see the back.
In this top paddock, you've got 7 or 8 long mounds.
These are often called hugel culture. It's a technique of piling dead and rotted logs and branches and prunings and stuff, and then covering it with soil and other biodegradable mulch and stuff, and then using that as a planting location. And it's sort of like a big sponge or the hump on a camel, so it absorbs moisture during the wet times, holds it in the wood and in the all that matter, and then it's available later to the plant roots that can tap into that.
So what's it called? Hugel culture?
Hugel culture, yeah.
And is that from Germany?
Germany or Austria, or it's a European technique that they use in the forestry areas to make use of otherwise surplus, discarded, rotten, you know, slash and stuff from the forestry. But yeah, that's what we've done here. And it gives you more surface area too, which means if you were planting something that was a ground covery type thing like strawberries, you'd actually fit more strawberries on this mound than if it was perfectly flat ground. So that might be a valuable consideration if you have a very small piece of land. And so it works somewhat similar to a swale in that rainfall that's landed uphill of here, again, once the ground has been saturated, anything that's running over the surface will get intercepted by this pile, this kind of dam essentially of material, and will get sort of absorbed and wicked up into that pile. And I mean, it's amazing just how much moisture a log can hold. I mean, if you think about it, picking up a dry piece of wood versus one that's been soaking in water for a long time, you know, that could easily be 3 times heavier or more, you know, so it can absorb quite a bit of water.
And this pile of wood that you have covered in topsoil is 8 to 10 meters long. It's about 2 meters wide and about 3/4 of a meter high.
Yeah, well, that's just this particular one. I mean, you could go any scale, really. It's just a matter of how much material you have that you want to move around. And so these ones were created a little over a year ago. And we had pumpkins out of off a couple of them. And here we've got beans and stuff growing and salad type stuff.
Now, I'm guessing you don't use any chemicals or pesticides on this land.
That's right. No, we're completely organic, although we're not certified in any way. We just, we're not using any herbicides or fungicides or pesticides for our fruit or vegetables or anything. So, and even the animals, you know, they're not getting any sort of vaccines or anything like that. So it's all nature as nature would do it, really. Yeah.
Now, beyond the paddock here, where you have several successful examples of hugel kultur, is a pig shed.
Yeah, this shed was here. Actually, all the buildings were here, so we haven't had to do any construction. We've just modified it a bit, as you'll see. We've converted we're in the process of converting the north side of this shed. It's about 12 metres long by, 5 metres wide or something. It was an eight bay pig shed, and we're converting the north side of the 4 bays on the north side of that into a plastic house so we can grow a bit more stuff undercover out of season, things like tomatoes and chilies and cucumbers and stuff.
Now I can see a couple of ducks and a large black pig.
Yeah.
That's Rota.
Hello.
Come here, Rota.
Do you have these pigs for meat or for pleasure?
They're our friends, so yeah, they're not for meat. And they do eat the grass and keep it short for us, and they do make really good manure for the garden. So yeah, and they're quite fun. They have really good personalities.
Yes.
They're just part of the whole lifestyle out here. Yeah. Sometimes I just come visit them because they like to be scratched and big fat tummies.
And ever since we got the pigs, which live in the same building as the chickens, we haven't lost any of our fowls to wild animals like ferrets or wild cats. So Not exactly sure why, maybe just the presence of the pigs in some way is keeping away those predators.
Now I'm climbing over the little fence, and Rota's right here beside me, a gorgeous jet black cooney cooney pig, and I'm giving her a scratch on her back. Oh, she's quite spiky. Oh, you like that, don't you? Now, what sort of ducks have you got here?
These are Muscovy ducks. I think they're actually technically a type of goose. But this one, which is the mother of all these little ones, or these two little ones, I think she's part paradise duck.
Okay.
Because I think paradise ducks are actually a type of goose, technically. So, her offspring, they're a bit smaller than normal, and they don't have as much red around the face, not like him, who's Dimitri, and he's very red in the face.
He was doing a bit of huffing and puffing just before.
Yeah, they're a little bit territorial.
That's the way they communicate mostly, is through kind of hissing and huffing and puffing and wagging their tails.
And these guys, we do get a few eggs from them, but their main purpose really is just for fun. And they distribute quite a lot of good manure
if you
around
look
the place.
In the bathtub there, they swim in that.
So what happens here is the rainwater comes off the roof and into this bathtub. And it's set up in such a way that the plug hole is blocked with a vertical pipe. And once the level of the bathtub raises above the top of that pipe, then it goes down through the pipe and out through the bottom of the plug hole. So the water stays in the bath. The bath sort of stays somewhat full. And the ducks enjoy that.
But then the manure that's in there, it comes out as it overflows and goes into the swales over there.
So if we want to top up the swale, we can just put the hose in here and flush this stuff through into the swale network, which... So another interesting design approach is to have animals like this on uphill side, living on uphill side of a fruit production area like this. And so all of that nutrient is sort of passing down through the root zone of these trees. And they've been here for maybe 3 years. And so, I mean, they're well taller than I am. So just having a bit of extra water around
makes a
huge difference. That's right, yeah. And all we've really done is just made a small change in the shape of the land, and it's away. Now we don't really do anything.
Are you self-sufficient?
No, not entirely, but it's something we're sort of working towards. I guess you could say the fact that we don't really have to buy vegetables or fruit is quite good. I think I bought maybe one bag of carrots in the past year, just because we didn't have carrots at the time and I quite wanted some, but that was a bit of a luxury. It didn't have to happen. Yeah, so it's good not having to buy that kind of thing, and we get our own eggs and from the chooks, and we do eat some of our chooks, so yeah, there's a lot of stuff we don't have to buy.
Where were you living before you decided to move to this rather isolated location?
Yeah, it is isolated. Before we were here, I have a background in IT, and I lived and worked in Wellington for about 8 years, and that's where I met Melissa, and we were in Christchurch for 2 years before we were here. So we were living in an urban environment and rented property, and it was always quite a frustration to me that I couldn't really make decent garden, and anything substantial that I did, have to walk away from it at some point. And even wanting to be able to improve the house or the dwelling that I was in, it's something you can't really do in rented situations. So finally making the move here, while it was quite different, it's also something that I'm familiar with from my childhood, and it gave us all those freedoms to do the things that had been in the back of my mind for a long time. And I think we're both pretty happy with it.
Melissa, what was it like for you moving from an urban life in Christchurch to this cottage here on the edge of a cliff?
It was really nice. I grew up in a very rural setting, so I just feel like this is home now, and I didn't really enjoy Christchurch very much. Being here is so peaceful, and you just listen to the birds and walk around the garden, and it just feels like the place I want to be.
What sort of work do you do, Olmec? to earn money.
I still work with computers, and that's our primary source of income, I guess. But other things, we have a little enterprise with the guest cottage, which we rent out through the Airbnb website, and people come through there and stay. And Melissa's actually written a couple of little children's books. So we have a few different income streams, and we're looking at other things, you know, potential in the future with some of the nut trees that we've planted, or we do sometimes have workshops and educational things here. So we're sort of, I guess I sort of think of myself as a lifestyle entrepreneur, and trying to find ways that I can do what I'm doing anyway and use that to pay our bills. And our bills are pretty small, so yeah.
Quite a switch going from working the land to working a computer.
Yeah, I guess so. I find them kind of complementary in some ways. I mean, I can do the computer when it's raining or dark or whatever, whereas out in the land it's very hands-on. And when you're in front of the computer, your brain is tied up with the computer and your body is tied up just sitting there in the chair. Whereas when you're out doing something with the plants or whatever, your hands are busy, but your brain is there for yourself to think about things. But then the other side of it too is that working with computers, you end up dealing with a lot of sort of abstract systems in your head and how to connect them together and thinking through different sort of scenarios and all this. And it's actually not, in some ways, it's not that different from thinking about all these different natural systems that exist, you know, the weather patterns and the water and pests and plants. And so I think all of that time that I've spent dealing with these electronic systems has actually kind of prepared my brain in a way that helps me think about these other things. So yeah, there's been that as well.
Now we're standing on the edge of your property looking up the gully.
Being really steep like it is, I think has helped save this bush, because the animals can't really get down into there, and there's been no reason to sort of clear it out and develop it into grassland or anything. No. It's very steep, and the sides of it are quite sort of rocky and crumbly, so the trees have been in there for a long time. And you can see those beech trees that are very red brown. I think there's some that have died in this most recent drought, or at least they've died back. I don't know whether they'll come away again or not, but yeah, those ones on the highest side of the gully there, it must have really dried out and they've shocked a bit.
Now beyond the gully, we can see the hills. What are they called?
Well, this one at the back here with the ridge of pines right at the way in the distance, that's Mount Parnassus. And that's essentially everything that you can see there is one big farm. It used to be, I think, Parnassus Station or something like that. And it was a government farm for quite a while. Mm. And now it's just a big private farm. And they've got sheep and beef up there.
Yeah, quite steep, hilly, rolling country.
It is pretty steep. And I think most of the people around here, because it's been so dry and they've been so low on feed, they've really had to reduce the numbers of animals that they're carrying. And so there's not many sheep out there at the moment.
That was Olmec Sinclair. Cosmo was also talking to Melissa Sinclair at their property near Cheviot. And if you'd like to see a gallery of photos Cosmo took during his visit, go to the Country Life webpage.